So what happened? Well, I would call it a kind of reality check. The reality check in Australia-China relations has been the recognition in recent years that a number of connected phenomena were occurring. China had changed, or it had not changed. Perhaps instead, some core elements of the PRC had become more apparent to the Australian policy community. That is, China was not going to liberalise. Indeed, under Xi Jinping, it was going very much in the opposite direction. There was a recognition that Chinese assertiveness, coercion, and military modernisation were beginning to threaten the regional balance and the rules-based order on which Australia's interests depend. There was a perception in Australia that China was beginning to extend its presence and its influence closer to Australia, into the Indian Ocean, the South Pacific, Southeast Asia, and of course inside Australia itself. There was a growing awareness, I think driven by intelligence and media reporting, that the PRC, that is the Chinese Communist Party and its proxies, had been taking advantage for many years of the openness of Australian democracy through tactics of co-option and control, for instance through community organisations or dominance of the Chinese language media in Australia. It's fair to say that Confucius Institutes were the least of our worries. And finally, a realisation over several years that pushing back against all of this would just get more difficult and more disruptive the longer that we waited. So, in the Australian experience, this alarm, if you like, was sounded gradually by intelligence and a small number of highly persistent and professional investigative journalists in Australia's mainstream media. It's fair to say that the watchdogs of a liberal democracy actually did their thing, right to the point where now the United Front Work Department of the Chinese Communist Party has become a household term in the Australian political discourse and something to be wary of. Now, the political class in Australia was slower to, I guess, wake up to this debate, wake up to these warnings. And a huge part of the problem that perhaps we have in Australia more than you have here is that our political parties had become dependent on foreign funding, quite an extraordinary turn of events. Over the last decade, until a couple of years ago, the two largest donors by far to the major parties in Australia, the Liberal and Labor parties, were two Chinese-born billionaires who had been named in subsequent briefings provided to those parties by the Australian Security Intelligence Organisation. Even slower to recognise the risks, I think, was the business community in Australia and a range of other constituencies with a strong material interest in overlooking the downsides of a reliance on the PRC. Now, if I had time, I could give you a quick chronology of these events, and perhaps in our Q&A discussion we can go into some of the specifics, because over the past 2 years there have probably been perhaps 20 or 30 key dates and data points on the evolution of this debate. But let's move on for the moment and instead pick up on a few of the themes. One, the big theme of political donations, spiking interestingly around election time, perhaps that's not surprising. Another big theme, the theme about community mobilisation, that is mobilisation or depending how you want to see it, I guess direction or infiltration of community groups in Australia. Most apparent, I guess, as an alert to the wider Australian community through the Olympic torch relay in 2008, where, and for those of you who've been to Canberra, you know it's a rather quiet, sleepy place where many thousands of people were mobilised to drown out, I guess, human rights protests and to support the torch relay. Canberra had never seen anything like it. There were bumpy times under previous governments, particularly under the Labor government of Kevin Rudd, but nothing reached, I think, the intensity or the scale of tension in the relationship until the last probably 3 or 4 years. It's notable that from about 2013 onwards, Australia, under a newly elected Conservative government, took an increasingly direct stance towards China on the East China Sea and the South China Sea. And it's interesting that around this time we began to see orchestrated protest activity in Australia on these issues. There was also not long after that the establishment of a think tank at an Australian university with a large founding donation from one of the two Chinese billionaires who I've mentioned. there was, from about 2015 onwards, very direct warnings provided to our political parties, to the, I guess, the leadership of those parties, by the Australian intelligence community, about risks that were perceived to be associated with their donor relationships. There was one particular report during the election campaign in Australia in 2016 of one of these donors reportedly threatening to withdraw a substantial donation from the Labor Party over its policy on the South China Sea. And then there were, I guess, a number of big investment or investment-related decisions, including a couple of specific examples of decisions being to delay or block major Chinese investments that really, I guess, elevated controversy and attention in the relationship. So notably, again in 2016, the government's decision to block a major piece of Australian electricity infrastructure, Ausgrid, from being sold to a Chinese buyer. A media report has since claimed this was related to that infrastructure's role in support of the intelligence joint facilities with the United States. So, by the second half of 2016, it's fair to say that the reality check in Australia was well underway, and perhaps that was in the policy community not fully being felt in the wider public debate. It's around that time that two things happened. One is that the Australian government commissioned a classified internal report led by a former prime ministerial advisor and indeed journalist, John Garneau. But also the political controversy over foreign donations began to spill into the public domain around particular individuals in the Labor Party. And the most extraordinary revelations on that score came over the payments from Chinese and Chinese-Australian business figures to a high-profile Labor senator who I've mentioned, Sam Dastyari, and his overt support for China's policy on the South China Sea. It's fair to say that Russian interference in the US presidential election played into Australian perceptions at this time and further galvanised our security agencies in late 2016 into thinking about how to protect Australian democratic institutions. In 2017, the relationship began to enter an even more troubled phase when, for instance, a visit to Australia by Chinese Premier Li Keqiang failed to secure parliamentary ratification of a bilateral extradition treaty or indeed official agreement on the kind of comprehensive Belt and Road MOU that China wanted. And at the same time, as the controversy, I guess, continued to mount, a Sydney-based academic, Dr. Feng Chongyi, a Chinese-Australian, was detained in China. I should add, a permanent resident of Australia, not a citizen, was detained in China, and it was later revealed that he was interrogated about dissident networks in Australia. This was seen as clear intimidation of Chinese-Australians. And so, I guess the drumbeat of media revelations continued until mid last year, when the respected Australian Broadcasting Corporation and the Fairfax newspaper company released a landmark report titled Power and Influence. Now, this was contentious. It summed up much of the debate so far, had some new revelations and allegations. Indeed, a few aspects of it remain subject to litigation from a Chinese-Australian billionaire, so I won't go into so much detail at this point. But it was an important moment in raising a new political awareness and consensus. Both major parties in Australia immediately announced that they were no longer accepting donations from the two billionaires, and the government announced that it was conducting an internal review with a view towards foreign interference and counter-espionage legislation. In other words, a review informed, presumably, by the preceding classified Garneau report. The media reports continued, and interestingly, ASIO, our security intelligence organisation, became much more direct in its public reporting of concern about foreign interference, making it clear that the levels of interference in Australia had reached something not seen since the Cold War, or indeed during the Cold War. Late last year, the Foreign Affairs White Paper that I've mentioned was released, confirming, I guess, the independence of Australian foreign policy in the Indo-Pacific. At the end of last year, Senator Dastyari finally resigned from Parliament after some extraordinary further revelations that he had provided his donor with counterintelligence advice. And then in the same month, the two bills, the Foreign Influence and Foreign Interference Bills, were introduced into the Australian Parliament. And what our then Prime Minister said at that point is important, but I'll come back to that. also in December 2017, in a very tightly fought by-election for a critical parliamentary seat, there was one of the first allegations of foreign electoral interference in Australia through a widely circulated message encouraging Chinese Australians to vote against the supposedly anti-China government. And separately, the Labor candidate in that election accused the government of anti-China racism. So I guess around that point we were seeing perhaps a high point of heat and not enough light in the debate in Australia. But the debate gathered pace throughout the first half of this year, really quite intensely during the formal consultation process for the new laws. Politicians, vested interests, lobby groups, community groups, industry, universities, media, prominent academics all weighed in to the debate with a whole range of motives. And the debate certainly had its low points, one of which for me was the regrettable intervention by former Prime Minister Kevin Rudd, in which he accused the government of anti-China jihad, and the extraordinary statement by the Vice-Chancellor of a university, not my own, accusing the government of Sinophobic blatherings. But fortunately, the debate moderated and moved on from that point. And it is important to note that the strong language was not all from one side. In February of this year, of course, was the publication of an extraordinary book, Silent Invasion, China's Influence in Australia, by a left-leaning public ethics academic, Clive Hamilton. This was a critical, refreshing, but in some cases overdone, intervention from the left, focusing on the risk to civil liberties and democratic institutions. We soon saw the publication of rival petitions by Australian academics, one attacking the perceived anti-China racism of the gathering debate, the other emphasising that the debate had to be had, while also acknowledging the need to reassure Chinese Australians and to prevent xenophobia, because of course racism in Australia does have history. Meanwhile, attention in the Australian debate began to turn outwards to Australia's borders and beyond to emerging reports of Chinese presence and interest in the South Pacific, and we'll see more on that, I suspect, later this year. But to, I guess, pull it all together, by the middle of this year, the Australian parliamentary system worked. The heat was beginning to ease out of the debate. I guess more efforts at reaching common ground, particularly among our political elites, became apparent. A bipartisan committee recommended many changes to the draft laws to accommodate justified concerns over civil liberties. And on the 28th of June this year, the historic new foreign interference and foreign influence legislation passed in the Australian Parliament. Now, at the same time, concern had mounted in the Australian community, particularly the business community, about how all of this was being perceived in China. And a sense, I guess, was reflected within that community that China was indeed seeking to leverage or coerce Australia economically and diplomatically, for example, by withholding certain high-level visits or business approvals. And so I guess there were sighs of relief in parts of the community when on the 7th of August, not long ago now, the then Prime Minister Turnbull went to a university to give a reasonably positive speech on Australia-China relations. This was hailed by some, I guess, as a reset and the end of the national security dominance of the relationship. I don't quite see it that way. I think it was very much a necessary modulation, a rebalancing of the debate, but the government has not walked away from any of its national security measures. And of course, this was borne out just very recently on the 23rd of August when the Australian government announced restrictions on certain foreign investment or involvement in the nation's upcoming 5G network, effectively banning Huawei and ZTE from investing in that network. And it's worth, perhaps if we have time, repeating what the then Australian Treasurer, now the Prime Minister, actually said. Of course, to end the narrative, the next day, for quite separate reasons, related to Australia's own political troubles, Prime Minister Turnbull stepped down to be replaced by his Treasurer, Scott Morrison, as Prime Minister. And clearly, Morrison will show continuity on the national security issues I've outlined. So to conclude, what lies ahead? So I think we've been through clearly a bruising phase in the Australia-China relationship, but I think the spirit of the discussion, certainly from the view of the policy community, has been about finding a new equilibrium in the relationship with China, not about rejecting China outright. So what now? firstly, there is a need for continued reassurance. And so the modulation that we heard in Turnbull's university speech last month needs to continue without walking back from the national security decisions that have been made. There does need to be greater reassurance to Australia's Chinese communities. And I say communities plural because I think the perception that there is one Chinese community in Australia, if you like, has been part of the problem. The perception that somehow the Chinese state, the Chinese Communist Party, and the Chinese community in Australia are all on the same page. There is much greater distance and diversity in that relationship, but there does need to be more outreach and reassurance to Chinese-Australian communities. There's also the question now of whether and when the new laws will actually be used. And presumably, if prosecutions begin to take place under those laws, we certainly have to hope that the agencies get it right and that they only act when they've got a very, very strong prospect of success. Of course, it's conceivable that deterrence will be the function of the laws and that prosecutions will not need to take place. There continues to be a gulf between the business community and the government on these issues, and so there's a continued need for much more frank and inclusive outreach to explain to the Australian business community why national security is in their interest too, and perhaps for the business community and indeed the academic community to reflect their views with greater fidelity to government. One of the major pieces of unfinished business in Australia is the need to ban foreign political donations to Australian political parties. It is a glaring, embarrassment in Australia's place in the world that our political parties have been so open to, and in some cases, frankly, venal about foreign political funding. There is, in theory, agreement right across Parliament on a need for a ban on foreign political donations, but somehow getting there has eluded our process until now. There's a need to message and sustain a new sense of normality in Australia's relations with China, because things probably will get worse again at some point. But of course, the Australian government will need discipline in the way that it handles that and pushes back and knows when to speak and when not. There could well be further fallout from the Huawei decision as well, although also, I guess, repercussions as other countries begin to take note of the Australian decision. And I think it's important in this town for me to say that there needs to be some degree of distinction between Australia's sovereign pushback against Chinese state interference in Australia and the more comprehensive sense of US-China strategic competition that we are seeing emerge. Certainly as the United States takes its own lessons from the Australian experience, I would encourage for the United States to think in very nuanced rather than crude terms about this issue, and I appreciate that is a challenge with this administration. The last challenge I see ahead is for Australia and its neighbourhood. I mean, in a sense, Australian foreign policy makers have always looked at the South Pacific, at least since the 1940s, at the South Pacific, in other words, Australia's neighbourhood, as an area where the primary issues were about governance, about sustainability, about order, about human development and so forth, resource management, not strategic issues. Suddenly, in the last year or so, we've seen a convergence of strategic competition in the Indo-Pacific and the transnational and human security issues of the South Pacific begin to converge. And I think Australia is beginning to see China as a direct strategic competitor in its own backyard. So that's something I think we need to watch very closely. It's fair to say things will never quite be the same again in the Australia-China relationship, and on balance, that's a good thing. I'm going to close by quoting the man who was, until very recently, our Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull. Now, however else history may judge him, I think he will in time be recognised for his leadership, however initially reluctant, in changing the way Australia engages with China, in the direction of sovereignty, security and self-respect, which I think is a prerequisite of the mutual respect we want in that important relationship. Malcolm Turnbull was criticised, rightly I think, for his rhetorical excess when introducing Australia's foreign interference laws as an example of Australian people standing up for their sovereignty. He made an allusion to Chairman Mao's supposed remark in 1949 that the Chinese people had stood up. He didn't need to see that. He didn't need to say that, I'm sorry. And he certainly didn't need to repeat it the next day in his rather imperfect Mandarin. It's a shame, though, because far more important and profound is the line that came before it in what was a really significant speech to the Australian Parliament, replete with context and worth reading in full. He said, "Our relationship with China is far too important to put at risk by failing to clearly set the terms of healthy and sustainable engagement." Thank you. Yeah, I'll set your breakfast here.
Excellent. Well, we've got about half an hour for questions, and I can already see a couple of hands up. So just a couple of ground rules. Please just introduce yourself and any affiliation you might have with the questions. If there's a lot, I might collect a couple together. I will abuse my position as chair to ask the first one. And that is, this was a fascinating and extraordinarily rich talk. Thank you very much, Rory. But one of the things I noticed was that kind of looking at the foundation or the bedrock of this was an acknowledgement, but not an explicit discussion of the economic relationship. And it seems to me that one of the issues here you have in the modern Australian-Chinese relationship is it's built upon a bedrock where neither of these powers have had significant economic downturns in the past 20 years. And I wonder, I mean, that will at some point in time happen. When it does, if somebody knows, let us all know, and we can go in the stock market for that. But how do you think that broader fact, i.e. that the Australian-Chinese relationship has been built upon a bedrock of economic stability, which will at some point in time be challenged, play into this, if at all?
That's a disturbingly good question, and not something that I have a ready-made answer to. Look, I think that it's important to emphasise the scale of the economic relationship. I think there's no question that Australians perceive that China, if you like, saved us during the financial crisis. There's a very strong memory in Australia, I think it's a memory now as much as a reality, of how important the mining boom was to Australia's economic health in the early part of this century. And of course that rapid growth was principally but not solely around China. I think there is an outsized perception of what else is happening in the economic relationship. I mean, certainly China's very important for our tourism, for universities, becoming more important for agriculture. But Australians perhaps don't realise really how limited Australia is as a trading power. The Australian economy is less exposed to trade than quite a number of other economies in the world. Trade as a proportion of GDP is significantly lower in Australia than for a lot of other countries in Asia. So we are vulnerable, of course, to economic downturns and economic pressure, but the political management of the vulnerability is really, I think, where we would see, I guess, outcomes change. There's a few elements I didn't touch on in my remarks. I mean, one of the really tricky issues in Australian domestic politics, including at a state level, has been the whole real estate question. The fact that there's a popular perception that the rise in house prices in Australia has been linked to growing foreign ownership, including particularly from Chinese Australians or from Chinese nationals. That's often been, I guess, a bit exaggerated in the popular imagination, and it's really important to separate that issue from the issue of PRC or CCP interference. But it does raise the question of how the relationship would be affected if either you have downturn in property prices that I think we're seeing in Australia, or if indeed somehow the unaffordability issue arose again. And then finally, we're seeing in Europe and the United States and elsewhere, there's that obvious question of what happens to nationalism and populism in Australia, including on the right, and including, I guess, those at the moment, thankfully, splinters of the extreme right in Australia, if somehow they can perceive that either China is to blame for their woes or something else. I don't see that as an acute problem in Australia, and I think one reason for that, as I've discussed with others here this week in this town last week, where you're going through your own interesting democratic turbulence, is that Australia has compulsory voting, and therefore in the Australian electoral system, moderate voices are almost always privileged. It's very hard to mobilise extreme organisations in Australian politics. So I think we will watch this space. I think that there is an aspiration in Australia to deepen and diversify economic relationships to match the diversification of our security relationships. It's easier said than done because there is no obvious substitute for China.